You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
You know, the vast majority of us are conscientious enough and intelligent enough to do different kinds of work. But I think for a certain part of the population, there's this little like bell ringing in the back of your head. You don't even know what that bell really means. But that bell is your artistic bell.
Hey, Donnie.
Deesha.
I'm so excited for today's show. I love Maurice Ruffin. I'm just a fan.
I mean, who isn't? Like, whenever you need a little burst of, like, keep going energy on whatever you're writing, you can just, like, find Maurice on the internet, on Twitter, yes, just dropping random gems. And then besides that, he writes books that are full of such beautiful character, such beautiful writing, such strong voice. We're so excited to talk to him today.
Welcome to the Ursa Podcast, where we celebrate the best in short fiction. You can support the show by going to ursastory.com/join or by leaving a review and comment on Apple Podcasts. I'm Deesha Filia.
And I'm Donnie Walton, and we are delighted to be joined today by Maurice Carlos Ruffin. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you know who Maurice is. The people know Maurice. But just in case you need a reminder, he is the author of two books of fiction, We Cast a Shadow, a novel that was a finalist for the Penn Faulkner Award, the Penn Open Book Award, and the Dayton Literary Peace Prize, and longlisted for the Center for Fiction First Novel Prize and International Dublin Literary Award. And the book we'll be obsessing over today, called The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, a 2021 story collection that we absolutely adore. And so the New York Times, by the way, which wrote, Ruffin writes with the clipped motion of the best comic books and the unsparing tenderness of a poet. The collection was also a finalist for the Ernest J. Gaines Award for Literary Excellence and longlisted for the Story Prize. A recipient of an Iowa Review Award in Fiction, he has been published in the Virginia Quarterly Review, Agni, the Kenyon Review, the Massachusetts Review, and Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas. A native of New Orleans, he is a graduate of the University of New Orleans Creative Writing Workshop and a member of the Podunk Writers Alliance. Maurice, I am going to add a little addendum here as I welcome you. Twitter sage.
Yes.
Which is, I go to your account so much for inspiration when I'm struggling. You are a light to so many writers on Twitter. So I want to thank you for that and ask you how you started doing that. What inspired you to just drop freely gems of wisdom every day?
Well, it's a great honor to be here. So thank you so much for having me today. I love your work and I love you both so much. So this is a great pleasure for me. You know, Twitter is an interesting place because it's gone through changes. I've been on Twitter since about 2008, I think. And I just recognized that in the past 3, 4, 5 years, it had become extremely negative. Mm-hmm. And I saw myself falling into the patterns of saying the same kind of things that other sort of popular people were saying. And I was like, I don't want to be that. You know, what kind of light do you want to spread in the world? And I just decided that as much as possible, I would keep it, I would keep my feed positive. And because many of my followers are writers like myself, I wanted to make a point to just say what I'm feeling about my own writing, whether I'm a little anxious, but more often I'm feeling very hopeful. I wanted to give that vibe to other people out there and let them know that they're not alone and it's okay to have a good attitude about writing.
Well, it is much appreciated on my end.
Absolutely. I always refer to you as the nicest person on Twitter, which I think says a lot.
Wow.
So should we jump into, we got lots of questions for you.
We have so many questions. Oh my goodness.
Let's start in the beginning. The epigraph for the collection is a quote from Ellis Marsalis, and it reads, in New Orleans, culture doesn't come down from on high. It bubbles up from the street. And so my question is, besides the setting. What makes the stories in your collection New Orleans stories?
You know, I think that New Orleans is so unusual. You know, it's hard to define it. People try to, you know, if you watch a movie or if you watch a TV show and New Orleans is in it, there's always these exaggerations that involve like accents and Cajuns running around constantly. People are throwing chicken feet at each other, doing voodoo constantly. And, you know, the real New Orleans is a lot different from that. You know, first of all, it's a southern city. And yet most of us don't sound conventionally southern. Like, I sound a variety of like, you know, New York, New Jersey, sometimes Jamaican, who knows, based on the mood. But then there's this feeling, and that relates to the culture of like the second line, for example. You know, when our loved ones die, often we will have a parade with the funeral. And the parade is this really joyous thing that includes a brass band and people waving handkerchiefs in the air and laughing. And that's sort of like laughing in the face of literal death is a big part of the New Orleans attitude. Mm-hmm. You know, on the one hand, because of the history, there's a lot of sort of nihilism built into it. It's this idea that New Orleans will one day flood, for example, and never become unflooded. But in the face of that, you still have your loves and your family and the things you like to do. And we're going to do those things regardless of whether or not the city is, you know, flooding slowly or it's being gentrified, you know, to death or whatever those things are. We're going to stay in our own space and give you that. So this book reflects that attitude of what I think we often call resilience and love of culture.
One of the things that I love so much about this book is that it's so many of the stories are anchored by very strong voices. And I often, as I was reading, found myself reading out loud, just naturally, just starting to read those stories. And I was curious about, you know, as your stories went through an editing process, you know, Deisha and I have laughed before about, you know, being in voice and phrases that, of course, we as Black folks know, you know, but that a copy editor might flag. And like, I screamed to see you use the word pure D,
yes,
which I also use in my novel. So love that. And so I'm just wondering about what that process was like for you to hold on to those voices, to get into them and to hold on to them throughout all those edits.
Oh, sure. I mean, it's really important. I don't know how to represent my community without those voices being brought forth as authentically as possible. I mean, shout out to Nicole Counts, my editor at One World Random House.
Yes.
You know, Nicole is brilliant and Nicole understood the assignment and we never, ever had any issues about, you know, what does this language mean? Is this like a Southern thing? What are you trying to do? You know, if anything, you know, Nicole's work's more conceptual and structural and helping me figure out the sort of shape of the collection so that things fit together well. But in terms of like us having this exchange of understanding, it was never an issue even one time.
That's wonderful.
That's great. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah. And it's also important to note, I think Nicole is Black. And I think that helps a lot, you know,
absolutely,
in the fact that, you know, we trust our work with each other, and to have an editor that is going to really help you maintain that voice throughout the whole process, I think is great. I had that experience as well, and I'm thankful for it.
Nicole, it was as close as I could get to having Toni Morrison as my editor.
Ooh,
so there you go.
Yes.
Ooh.
Yes. That's wonderful.
Wow. Love that.
So let's keep talking about voice and voices and point of view. So in the titular story, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, as well as in the stories Beg, Borrow, Steal, Token, and Catch What You Can, you use the second person point of view. And it's a choice that for me as a reader, it compounded the often devastating emotional impact of those stories. How do you decide on a point of view for a given story?
You know, I feel like the point of view chooses me. I've often said that for me, it's almost like a seance. I'll sit down to write a story and I'm not going to have any idea what's going to come out. And I begin to hear the voice, and then the voice has a sort of rhythm and a cadence and has these concerns. And I think that the second person stories in particular, like the title story, those I use that point of view when the character is just extremely pressed. I mean, their anxiety can't get very much higher than it already is. And they're going to be in that space throughout. And, you know, it's not for nothing that a lot of those characters are very young people. So like Catch What You Can, or in the title story, for example, but also in Token, which is this person like just trying to explain this great level of pain they've experienced as a Black man in a very white space in their employment. And so that second person is like, it's almost saying, I can't even look you in the eye right now. I'm just going to just tell you this story as I'm looking off to the side, and you, and I can't even see myself because it hurts so much. So it's like, you know, you do this, you do that, you feel this, and it carries across like that. Mm-hmm.
So let's kind of go back, you know, before two books under your belt from the very beginning. Do you remember your first story that you were published, you know, where it was published, the year, what it was like getting that acceptance, that letter or email?
So there's sort of like a young Maurice who was like a teenager, and I was invited by this magazine editor in New Orleans to like write a short piece about young Black folks in high school, a fiction piece for her, like her neighborhood magazine. So I wrote that, and that was published in it. You know, I was so like clueless. I didn't even know what publishing was. I'm like, all right, I'll write something for her, and just gave it to her. And I've seen it. I'm like, wow, dude, you were definitely a kid back then. But like in more modern times, my first full size story was published in the South Carolina Review in 2011. And that was the culmination of about 7 years of keeping a spreadsheet of all my submissions and sending out stories the old fashioned way, like, you know, often mail, not online, because there wasn't even an option back then, and getting rejected for 7 years straight. And I remember thinking, you know, one day you're going to come home and it's going to be sitting there waiting for you, your first acceptance. And something happened where I was away from, I was like out of town. So when it got to my house, I didn't even see it for like a week after it came in. This is what your zone thing, but I remember that feeling of okay, maybe you can do this thing now, dude. You actually have some skills. So yeah.
So I know y'all can't see me, but I'm just smiling ear to ear because I think stories like that are so inspirational to writers who do go back to the page day after day after day and have that dream, you know, of having that publication, and it can happen, and look where you are now. It's just incredible. Yeah. Can we talk a little bit about the journey, specifically the publication journey of this collection? So you published the novel first, amazing, We Cast a Shadow. You had already had several of the stories in this collection written, is that right?
Yeah, several were already published. The story is funny because on the morning after my book release for We Cast a Shadow, my first book, I was having lunch with my editor at the time, was Victory Matsui, and my wife was there also. We were just kind of hanging out at a Creole soul food spot in New Orleans. I go to the restroom, come outside, and they have cut a deal behind my back to sell this collection.
What?
And I was like, wait, what happened? I was like, what are y'all talking about? It was shocking because on the one hand, I was kind of like I had enough stories that I actually could have published the collection before that book, but I made a choice to publish the novel first. And then I was still kind of like, am I ready to do the collection even then? And they kind of said, yeah, you totally are. And so I sold the collection. The process was me going through and figuring out, you know, the sort of shape and the sort of rules of the stories, and then writing a few new stories. And I really feel like, for me, it was interesting because some of the stories are a bit older, and the newer stories allowed me to try different techniques, different tactics, different topics. And I was like, oh, you still got it, kid. You can actually write a story in, you know, 2020, and it's going to feel like you know what you're doing. So it was a fun process.
So all three of us are, I would say we're a little bit late bloomers to this writing thing. We had different lives. I mean, Disha, you went to school for economics, right?
Allegedly, and yes. Unfortunately.
I was working in media. Maurice, you were a lawyer. Can you talk a little bit about that journey that you took and that decision that you made to leave the law? You wrote about it very beautifully in a newsletter that Disha's morning and we're discussing before we hopped on this call, but we'd love for you to share a little bit of that story with our listeners.
Sure. And thank you for that. It was fun writing that piece for Ulster. So I think that, you know, the vast majority of us are conscientious enough and intelligent enough to do different kinds of work. So you can find yourself, you know, going after a degree in marketing or media or accounting or law, and you can do an okay job doing those things. But I think for a certain part of the population, there's this little like bell ringing in the back of your head. You don't even know what that bell really means, but that bell is your artistic bell. I feel like if you take a room full of people, let's say a football stadium full of people, you know, 80,000 people in one big giant room, maybe only, you know, a couple dozen of people in that room are artists. And many of us, we don't really understand what that means. We think that, well, I can do something else in my life and that's going to be good enough. Or I can write my art or make my art on the side. That's good enough. In the same way, there's the highest use for like a physical property. Like you wouldn't turn a football stadium into like an ice cream stand or an ice cream truck into like a yoga studio. Some of us have our best use. And I figured out at a point that, you know what, the law is fine, but your best use is actually putting together these stories that reflect your community. Because they're not being told. If you don't tell them, what's going to happen, dude? And so for me, once I figured that out, it was no question. I was going to make the moves of co-founding writing groups, finding mentors and peers, you know, doing like readings with people together, going to school, taking independent workshops, trying to get published. And, you know, this idea of the hero's journey that Joseph Campbell had back in the day that we see in a lot of films from Star Wars to, you know, Black Panther, whatever like that. And this is my personal hero's journey. You know, I think that in the beginning of my story, I'm like this well-fed, well-paid, you know, three-piece suit-wearing, BMW-driving lawyer. And then they say in the beginning of the story, after you know who that person is, they have to change immediately. And so I was kind of like, this isn't my suit. This is my car. There's some other suit, some other car out there in the world for me, and I have to find that. And so I spend the next decade basically making the transition from full-time lawyer to full-time writer slash teacher of writing. And I have to say, you know, if you have this inclination inside of you, it's going to pay off. I have never felt happier in my life than to have lived this dream. I'm not going anywhere, but having made it this far, I'm like, you know what, dude, you kind of did your work. And that is a very satisfying feeling to have two books on the shelf that people can buy anywhere in the world and know that they will enjoy the experience.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So I am fascinated by short fiction. I mean, by flash fiction, I mean to say. Super short stories. And there are a couple in there. One that I'm going to mention is Election. And I felt an entire world pulsing in Election. And yet it's probably a page and a half in length. Maurice, how do you know when the story is done? Mm. How do you know that story just needs that space?
I didn't plan it this way, but I noticed in looking back on it, the flash pieces are mostly men and the full size pieces are mostly women and children and the longest piece is a woman. And I'm not sure why I was doing that, but I will say with a story like Election, for example, which you're right, is barely a page long, that voice was so strong and so present to me. And I think the reason why, that's actually one of the oldest stories in the collection. And, you know, I'm a cisgender heterosexual male. And I remember thinking about, well, what would it be like to be a young woman in a situation where there's this power dynamic and there's this love, and yet you know it's going to be unreciprocated, you know, unrequited. And, you know, as a guy, I never thought about it from a woman's point of view. And so once her voice just was talking to me so directly, it had its own energy. It had its own force. And with a lot of the flash pieces, I will often ask that character, you know, just go ahead and tell me briefly about the most important moment of your life. And that's what she's doing in that story.
Do you ever find yourself writing beyond the point that is the ending and then pulling it back? Or do you, when you end the story, you know it's finished?
Both. So some of the flash stories actually wound up becoming full-size stories because I have my little personal formula that I use when I'm making a flash story. It's like a scaffolding. And so Catch What You Can was a flash piece initially. And that was a story that would not be contained in just, you know, a couple pages. And then I've often written stories where I will, one of my mentors would always say, go to the next day. This is Neil Walsh, who teaches at UNO. He'd say, go to the next day and see what happens. And so I'd write those next days. And sometimes it works really well. So Before I Let Go, which is the novelette at the back of the book, you know, that's 40 pages long because I kept asking, well, what happens in the next day, in the next day, in the next day? But more often than not, I'll get to the end and I'll kind of go, no, this is exactly it. You know, in the title story, you can't go past that kid looking at the guy in the back of the police cruiser with the handcuffs on. There's nothing else to see from that point. You can extrapolate what he's going to do next. And that's what I want you to do. I want you to have your own thoughts about what this person's future is going to be like.
Now, you mentioned that formula. And that's something you've shared on Twitter before, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Can you share it again?
Of course, yeah. And I have to give credit to a writer named Paul Theroux, who I think that's who I learned the flash form from the most. He had a story. It was called a story called 22 Stories, but it was really 22 flash pieces back to back in one of the prize collections, like the O. Henry Prizes or the Best American Prize Collection. And so I read the stories, and each story had a different main character, a different point of view, a different voice, a different topic. And yet they all kind of added up, and it was this sort of rhythm that was in the stories. I couldn't figure it out. And I'm not even sure if he had broken it down this way himself. But what I noticed was, okay, there's a four-part structure. And I have claimed it as my own ever since. The four-part structure is the setup is the first part. You know, it's the sort of journalistic who, what, where, when, why, mm-hmm. and how. Then the second part is the complication. You've been brought into the space. Well, what's the bigger problem that's happening here? And then the third part is the ironic twist, which is whatever you've been setting up for the first half to 80% of the story, you turn it on its head. So if the character is trying to get water, you know, maybe they wind up, you know, tossed to the ocean, or they're trying to get water and next thing you know, they're in a desert. There's some sort of reversal of fortune. And then the end is just the conclusion, the fourth part of it. And I found that it was a good way for me to get into my stories as quickly as possible, maintain the sort of shape in the stories. And it just helps me to frame the structure of my stories.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
I'm over here taking notes.
Here's the thing. I wrote it down when I saw that you shared it on Twitter, but then I couldn't remember where I saved it and what I saved it under. So I'm glad you recapped.
Well, coincidentally, yes. It's also the same structure of classic comic strips like Garfield and Charlie Brown. You can see the same structure, 1, 2, 3, 4.
That makes me think of something else that Donnie and I have talked about is in terms of endings and this idea that, you know, endings, in order for them to be literary or sophisticated, there has to be this sort of ambiguity. You know, sometimes it's not. You know, sometimes there's just something satisfactory or there's satisfaction or some sort of clarity. Do you have a preference in terms of your endings?
Well, you know, endings are one of the hardest things to do in fiction in particular, because you built up so much energy through the plot and you have spent all this time building the characters, and people just have all these thoughts about them. Mm-hmm. And in most stories, the characters will survive past the last page. So how do you stop a story when that's the structure of it? And I give credit to all my friends and mentors who helped me over the years. When I was in grad school, my friend Che Yoon said that her mentors would always tell her, just find a powerful ending image. And I was like, what do you mean by that? It's like, well, just like, what is the character looking at? Or what is the space like that they're in at that moment? Mm-hmm. And for me, I've really followed that. In most of my stories, I will have a sort of opening image where you're like, again, that sort of setup, you know, the who, what, where, when, and what, you know, how's it happening? And then the ending is almost the reverse of that, a mirror image of it, so that you feel like you've gone on a journey. It's subconscious. You really can't tell, but you can feel it inside of you. And so the vast majority of my stories will end with, you know, this character in a place looking at something, and you're sort of looking through their eyes and kind of going, "Ooh, that's something. I can't believe that." Mm-hmm.
This leads very naturally into the story from this collection that you've already mentioned that is my favorite, Catch What You Can. And the ending of that story with the character, the little professor called Jean, tasting lobster for the first time. Can you talk a little bit about the origins of that story and give the listeners a quick summary of what it's about?
Sure. First of all, that story is probably the most autobiographical story in the entire book.
Wow.
Yeah, it's fictional, but basically it's my mama and me in like 1986, essentially, pretty much. The idea is this, you know, New Orleans, people don't really remember this today, but for a long time, New Orleans was one of like the top three cities in terms of population and economics. We were like, it was like New York, you know, Chicago, maybe Houston, and then New Orleans. And then things just changed really quickly. So, you know, from the 60s to the 80s, the population was shrinking. Then we experienced the worst part of the oil crash, the oil bust in the 1980s. And so these characters in this story, this mother and this son, are sort of dealing with the aftermath of that. They, you know, the mother has been having some problems. She was drinking too much. And at the in the beginning of the story, she asked the son, hey, look, I need you to go around our apartment and find all the half-drunken bottles of liquor and bring them to me. I'll give you $5 a piece so I can pour these bottles out and go find a job. And, you know, the father slash, you know, love interest, he's out of the picture now. And so it's really just these two people trying to form an understanding and an alliance. But of course, in New Orleans in the 80s, so much is going on. There's the drug war. There's the oil bust. There's all these things that are affecting people that they can't really see it. And so when they go downtown, you're seeing this sort of devastated area where even people who are trying to find, you know, good work for themselves to pay for their families and their lives, it's just not even available. And the story would be really dire, except for the fact that, you know, this mother and son love each other so much and have so much respect for each other in the story.
Yeah, that really shines through. It's a beautiful piece.
Thank you.
So Jean in that story, Donnie, you remember we were talking about that?
Yes, Jean. There's a character named Jean that pops up in another story. Is that the same Jean, Maurice?
Yes and no. Yes and no. The short answer is that when I made my thesis collection, you know, over a decade ago, my thesis director was like, you know, you should probably like link these stories. And we can talk more about it later on. But I've always been anti-linking stories. But there were a couple of stories where this character, Gene, is in multiple stories. But the thing is, like, now we have this idea in, like the MCU Marvel movies and TV shows, like Loki and all that, the multiverse. It's the same Gene, but from, like, different worlds, different times. So he's kind of the same dude, but kind of not.
So sort of like the Peter Parker thing, where it's, like, Peter Parker, Miles Morales, yes. Like, all
or
that.
Or even Tobey Maguire, yeah. You know, Andrew Garfield and Holland, the last kid.
You mentioned that you're anti-linking stories. I have to hear more about that. Why is that?
I am just naturally an iconoclast. You know, if everybody is swimming left, I'm going to swim right. I just can't help it. And so I know that traditionally older collections, like from, say, the 60s and 70s, you know, like your John Cheever and your George Carr Oates, often the stories were all separate and not linked. And then I think around the 90s or so, because of people like Junot Diaz and Drown and Amy Bender to a certain extent, other writers, this, I won't say it's a fad, but it's become like the standard style of, well, this short story collection is really a linked universe, or like in Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan, it's really just like one novel. And I've really always been enamored by the idea of you're in one story in one place at one time, and then the next story, you're somewhere totally different. And to me, that's very exciting. And I really get happy about, you know, going to that next story with that next idea and seeing how different it is from the previous story.
So I want to talk about my favorite story from the collection now. And I hope I'm saying her name right. Cesara?
Cesara Pittman.
Yes, Cesara Pittman, or A Negress of God. That's my favorite in the collection. And I'm really curious about the origins of it and then how you developed it from there.
This story was written maybe late 19, I think. And I hadn't read your work yet, but she reminds me the most of your fierce characters.
Oh,
and I think that's probably like your influence on me long term, because I just really feel like, I mean, we all are who we are in the world. And so oftentimes a person's first book is like, in some sense, their most autobiographical work. So my We Cast the Shadow, you know, features a black male Southern lawyer, mm-hmm. which is a lot of my demographics.
Right.
And so a lot of that story is given over to like certain elements of my own personality. He's more extreme than I am. But it's also in a lot of ways a very masculine book. I mean, the second and fourth main characters in the book, you know, is his wife and his mother, but they're sort of off to the sidelines. In my collection, as I've said, maybe half of the characters are women or girls who are leading the stories along. And I really felt like for me, I wanted to show a different angle. If the male characters are sort of like pushing things and causing more problems, I'm trying to show these women not as perfect, you know, not as like these flawless beings, but that sort of communal spirit mm-hmm. where Cesara very much is kind of going, this isn't really just about me. You know, I could try and take this guy down in court, get my justice. But this guy's out there doing this to other people
right.
who look like me as well. And I got to put a stop to that myself. So in a sense, she's like a proto superheroine, basically. Mm-hmm. She is just going out there and she's going to solve the problem by herself. And I was doing a lot of research for my piece in 400 Souls. And that inspired me to go further back in time than my typical time period and write this 1866 story.
And, you know, Donnie was talking earlier about voice. it's her voice that, you know, grabs you from the very beginning. And, you know, and even though it's set in 1866, she just sounded like, you know, every grandma, every Black grandma that I ever knew. but, you know, again, I mean, you touch on, as you said, you know, law, history, feminism, you know, I mean, she wouldn't use that word, but, you know, so much in about five pages. And that was just really, you know, beautiful to read. And just the spirit of that character, you know, just really shines through there. So I think that's, and I actually read the story. It's published somewhere other than your collection. Is that right?
It was online.
Okay. Here. Okay. That's right. Right. Because I read it, and then, you know, reading it when I got the collection, it just felt like revisiting an old friend. And even though I knew, you know, how it ended, that ending again was just very satisfying. And we do spoilers on this podcast. So there's some, we can say that there's some vigilante justice, and I love it. I'm here for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In my mind, she's basically my great-great-great-great-grandmother, who I could never actually meet, obviously, or even know what she sounded like. But in my mind, that's who she is.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious, Maurice, once you had, you know, you had a certain amount of stories ready for this collection, you felt they all belonged together, how did you go about ordering them? Do you have a philosophy about how stories in a collection should be ordered?
Well, you know, first of all, that's one more thing that I have to give huge credit to Nicole Counts for, because I really feel like by the time I got done with the collection, I was so worn out. I couldn't even really think straight. And Nicole was kind of like, well, we got to pick the order of these stories. And I was kind of like, I just kind of can't. I'm not sure what to do about this. And so she's a huge part of the order of the stories. That being said, I think generally speaking, I think about my favorite albums, whether it's, you know, Stevie Wonder's Songs in the Key of Life, or Tribe Called Quest with, you know, Low End Theory or Midnight Marauders, or any of the other albums. Oftentimes, the very first song is like the weirdest song. Like, it's the loudest, brashest, in your face. Mm-hmm. And it sort of sets a tone of like, all right, if you're really a fan, you want to be a part of this experience. Yes. You got to get through this first. And then I'll give you some of the easier stuff.
Yes.
And so,
it's like a Rorschach test.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If you got to go home, it's fine. You can stop reading right now. And so, you know, in this book, you know, definitely that title story in some ways is like the darkest, most aggressive of the stories, because it gets very bleak, you know. And if you can sort of see what's going on and experience that and get past that, then things aren't quite as rough sledding after that point.
Disha, I feel like in a way Eula sort of works the
it
same
did.
Way.
It did. You couldn't see me, but I was nodding in recognition. Same thing. Like, I said, what is the most provocative, most explicit story that I have to let people know this is what we're doing? And, you know, let me know if you're rocking with me or not. And it functions to hook even maybe the reader that's reluctant, because if nothing else, they're curious about what's going to come next.
And I have to say, you know, I had, of course, read such glowing reviews of your book. I was so excited to read it, Maurice. And I thought the title was so interesting. And I was so excited for that moment when I understood the context of that title. And it was so satisfying in the title story when we get to that moment where it's revealed. I was just gutted for that
character. That is the exact word that I would have used too. I was not ready. I was not ready for that at all. And I did. After I read that story, I had to put the book down before I picked it up again.
All right. Well, mission accomplished then.
Yeah.
Was there a moment when you knew? Did you always have that title in mind, or did the title come after you thought about it, after you'd finished the story and sort of looked through the story for something to pull to the front?
The title came pretty soon, but I wasn't sure about the collection's title. And I was struggling over it and going back through the entire collection and saying, well, you know, what's a hot bar here that I can use as a title? And I couldn't find anything at first. And then I came back to the title story. To the first story. I'm like, wait a minute, that's it right there. Like, why even, don't even overthink this. That's the perfect thing for this book. And so it became apparent pretty soon in the process of picking a title for the entire collection itself.
Mm-hmm. And why do you think it sort of is representative of the book as a whole, this title?
I think that what that character experiences in the title story is indicative of what a lot of New Orleans people, a lot of Black folks experience in the city, which is to say, you know, we're definitely a tourist economy because of the French Quarter. People come from all over the world constantly. And many of us work in the industry, whether it's at hotels or restaurants or out in the streets wearing costumes. And you have to be a sort of fake self. You have to present a false version of yourself to succeed in those spaces. And every once in a while, you meet somebody who kind of sees the real you and there's a connection there. And I think the book is very much about that, about trying to survive in a city that doesn't have a lot of money, a lot of resources, and yet people can find one another and that makes their lives livable.
Now, of the characters, and, you know, I think about the character in the title story, and, you know, it was one of many characters that I just wanted to wrap my arms around. And so this might be a bit like asking you like a favorite child, but do you have a favorite character from among the stories in the collection?
It's impossible. It really is impossible. I mean, the best I can do is tell you that on any given day, there's a different character I think that way about. Like, Before I Let Go was important to me because that is a story about a middle-aged lesbian Black woman in New Orleans. And in my experience, I'd never seen that character as a lead in a New Orleans story, not even in film or in television, unless you count maybe like, I'm not even sure, in like novels. So my idea was, all right, who is this person in that story Before I Let Go? Well, she's kind of like my auntie. She's like the ladies I've known throughout my entire life who are just living their lives and they don't get to be in the spotlight at all. And so giving her that spotlight for me was very cathartic. I felt like I was showing my people in a way that is, you know, honest and respectful, and you just don't see them otherwise. So I love that. But I will say, you know, all the kids, I just want to hug them too. The title kid, Catch What You Can kid. I mean, just they're going through so much mm-hmm. and they need as much love as possible, especially considering that the vast majority of them have Katrina in their background, which is this really intense incident that is where they started their lives at.
Mm-hmm.
Maurice, kind of zooming out to think about short fiction in general, where does a story start for you?
Yeah, before I knew anything, I used to try and write high concept, like a Hollywood screenwriter. You know, it's like, well, what if this person who is living halal right now decides to work in a pork factory? And it's like, no, that's not going to be a good idea. And so I finally grew out of that, and I got to the point where it was really, like I said earlier, I would just sit down and start writing, having no idea, you know, what the first line would be. And often what I would do is I will now maybe like write a page or a paragraph somewhere in between there. And in that process, the voice emerges and I'll go back and start to rewrite that first page or so. And then the voice becomes clear. And so that's, you know, that's your Cesara Pippin, for example. That's the title character, for example. And I'm just kind of saying, you know, what's really bothering you right now? What's on your mind? You know, what's this really important thing that is a part of your life? And it is going to tell me. And so the story always starts with the person's concern, their voice, their tone, and some sort of mixture of those things together is what makes the story lift off for me.
And let's talk about something now that a lot of writers don't enjoy. I actually enjoy it. And Donnie, you tell me if you enjoy it. Revision.
Mm.
Revision, the R word.
I love it.
I do too.
I love it.
I like it better than drafting. But Maurice, I'm curious, you know, how do you feel about revision? And can you take us through your process?
Yeah, I think that for any author, revision is really where you prove yourself. You know, anybody can bang out a draft and then just kind of hand it off and hope it gets published as it is, more or less, after getting rid of the typos. But the real deep work, the understanding of who these people are in this story
mm-hmm.
and what is really trying to be said by them in these stories, that to me is the revision. That to me is like this big chunk of marble that looks pretty good by itself. You start chipping away at it until it becomes more refined. You can see the facial features and the shape of the cheeks and that kind of thing. So I adore revision. And, you know, oftentimes I have to go through a process of like 2, 3, 4, 5 drafts. The title story is weird. I was in this space where I like wrote it really fast, mm-hmm. went back and gave like one more pass over. And that was basically it for that title story. But then the reverse of that is like Rhinoceros, which is, you know, the story that I wrote during the pandemic, during the protest. I actually started it in like late 19 and I just kept stalling out on it. And I had to get to the point of, you know what, this story needs a complete and total overhaul. I changed the lead character, the tone, the POV, the basic locations, and kept the first paragraph. And the story grew from that seed into what it is in the book itself. So revision is so important.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think some writers resist revision?
I think it's because for a lot of people, it feels like work. And I think what they're missing is that, I'm not being facetious really, but I am being a little facetious. Writing should almost never feel like work. if you're in a place where it is a struggle because of either writer's block or you're fearing the page or you don't want to get back to it again, you're not having a good time. And for me, writing is often, okay, how can I have more fun writing this? And a lot of my decisions come from that. You know, oh, this would be a lot more fun in second person than first person. Oh, no way. This would be more fun if the funny, you know, sidekick high schooler was the main character versus the guy I'm using right here already. And so when I had that sort of that light bulb over my head, that's like, oh, that'd be a lot of fun. Revision is no longer work. It's like, oh, I can't wait to try that out and see how it looks on the page.
That's a whole new way of thinking about it, to look for the fun. And I try to tell my students, like, if you're not having fun writing it, then what's the point? Yeah. You know, like, you have to be almost delighting yourself constantly in order to come back to that page or that computer screen day after day after day.
And I think it has to do with, you know, some of the elitism around writing. And, you know, just like we were talking about endings, this, you know, sort of mindset that for something to be high art or literary, you know, the ending has to be a certain way. And I think it's the same thing, this idea of like the tortured writer, you know, which I think, in addition to some gatekeeping, it's also a way to justify people procrastinating. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yes.
I'm just going to choose violence today and just say it.
Well, while we're on the note of revision, here's a provocative question. Is there a published story that you would go back and revise in some way if you could?
You know what? I thought long and hard about this. I actually don't think so. I really don't think so. Look, there are some stories that I wrote. I remember when I was trying to develop some new stories, and I found some of my grad school stories that I hadn't either finished or they just felt kind of incomplete. And I tried to rewrite them, and it felt terrible. It was like trying to have a conversation with like my four-year-old self, where it's like, okay, we're so far apart. Then there's stories in the collection where, like, I recognized that I was a younger writer. So The Pie Man is probably the oldest story in the collection. Like, I think I started that over a decade ago. And when I read it, I kind of go, oh, you know, you were trying to do this thing. You did it like, not, you know, 85%, but today you would do it 100%. Well, that's fine, because I really have respect for that, you know, that younger version of myself who was trying hard to write that story. I really had high standards for myself, which is to say that, you know, I would never send a story to a magazine I wasn't proud of, and I'd never send a story that I wasn't proud of in the moment. And I've maintained that level of like respect for those older stories even today. So I'm not kind of like, oh yeah, man, just try a new approach to the same idea. Because in some sense, because I am who I am, my themes will always come back to me, and I'll be writing the same story for the rest of my life anyway. So start a new version with a new title and new characters and then see where it goes.
Thinking about, well, you can think about this collection, and then, you know, We Cast a Shadow. What's the best sentence you think you've ever written?
That's a great question. You know, I'm a very positive person, so I like to hype my own stuff. I've told this story in the past about like how my greatest work ever is this scene that got cut out of We Cast a Shadow, which is when the lead character and his wife, before they're married, are like on vacation in Europe, like in a train going through the snow-covered Alps. And it's this sort of big love scene where like they actually consummate their love, and that leads to the birth of Nigel, the son, who appears in the main part of the book. And so I went back and reread that for the first time in years. And I was kind of like, this is okay. It's all right. I'm not so sure about that. So then on Sunday night, I did an event, one of my few live events of the entire pandemic. I was supporting Joshua Wynn, who's a poet, and Tiana Nobile, who's also a poet. And I read from the book this story, Token, is one of my flash pieces. I read like four flash pieces. And I hadn't realized that Token, which was having an effect on the audience, they were like into it. I'm like, okay, this is working pretty good. It's just one sentence, which is me taking the Jamaica Kincaid conceit from Girl and making this one extended idea. So that's my strongest sentence, which is Token, I think.
I think I realized that was just one sentence. Now I'm looking.
Semicolons, okay. Commas.
Wow.
No periods.
Yeah, and I love Girl. Wow. Oh my gosh, yeah.
Let's do a little fill in the blank. So, okay, the hardest part of writing a short story is?
And I say this only partly facetiously. The hardest part of a story is starting a story, because you never know how it's going to end up. If you do well, it will get published, and it'll be a part of your life for the rest of your life. So deciding to start a story is like deciding to have a kid, basically. Like, you're going to make this thing. You have no idea what it's going to be, and probably a blessing, maybe not so much. And so there's a bit of like anxiety with this idea of like, okay, it's the day to day you want to do this. You want to sit down and like spend like 4 hours cranking a draft out. No, I'm not ready for it today. And so just getting over like my thoughts of, you know, can I still do it? Am I good enough? Will this be a decent story? People like this? Can it get published? Getting past that, just sitting down and starting. Once I get started, it's mm-hmm. fine.
And what about this? My favorite part of writing a short story is...
There's no word for it, but I will say it's the third quarter, like in a basketball or a football game. And this is like, if the first quarter is like the first draft, and the second quarter is like this revision process, like, oh, that didn't make any sense. You should move that over here, yada, yada, yada. And then somewhere in that third quarter, I'm sitting there, you know, about two-thirds through it thinking, oh, I get this now. I know what this story is really about. In fact, now that I know what the story is really about, I can go back to the first page and change this. I can change that character's name to that. I can put this character in this scene setting over here. And it's this sort of like veteran editor feel of, I understand it now and how to make it a better story. That feeling to me is why I write.
I love that moment of unlocking it when it's like, you struggle with it. And it's like, oh, you hit on that thing that just lets the rest of the story just come out of you. It's a great feeling.
The unlocking, I liked it.
Yeah. Let's talk about every day you inspire writers on Twitter. Who are the writers who have inspired you or put out collections that you particularly love?
Two of the first ones that I just fell in love with, it was definitely ZZ Packer's book.
Mm-hmm. Drinking Coffee Elsewhere.
Yes, Drinking Coffee Elsewhere.
Exactly. Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. I mean, I'm pretty sure I'd never read a book by a Black person that was short stories until that point.
Same.
You know, in college, I had read a lot of other pieces and, you know, a piece here, you know, Jamaica Kincaid here, Alice Walker over there, yada, yada, yada. But like this entire collection by this young Black woman, and I was amazed by it. And when I tell you, when I first met her in person, like in a coffee shop, she didn't know who I was. And I was just like sitting there thinking, is that really ZZ Packer who just walked into this coffee shop in New Orleans? So just blew me away. There's that. There's Daniel Evans' first collection,
yes.
Before You Suffocate Your Own Fool Self.
That's right.
I was like, yo, how does she do this? It's so interesting. And then also, I think my first like general love was that when I began to like to write my own stories was reading a lot of collections that were anthologies. So I love the Best American Short Stories. I love the O. Henry Prize stories. But my favorite overall is the New Stories from the South, 2008, which ZZ Packer actually edited. And it's actually a defunct publication now, but it was always a very diverse publication. It was always like just the diversity of styles. It was the first time I kind of read a book and kind of went, these stories are all so different. And that makes me so happy to think I can do the same thing myself in my own work.
And when you say that, you're making me think about Nafisa Thompson Spires' collection, because that was how I reacted to hers, which is, ooh, you can do that, you know? And it's like, we give each other permission to experiment and try new things.
Well, I have to say with Nafisa, I would not have gotten my book over the finish line without her.
Wow.
Because I read her book on a plane going to AWP in like 2020 where I met her. And I read the book like on the plane. I saw her for the first time in person. I'm like, yo, girlfriend, you did this thing. I mean, she was on fire. Jamel Brinkley was on fire. Mm-hmm. Friday Black. I mean, that's another book where I'm like, yo, people are trying all these amazing concepts. Nana,
yes.
All these books were just like, okay, we are back. We are doing some things and we are legion now. It's not just like one or two of us.
That's
There's
right.
a whole bunch of us doing stuff.
That's right. So we asked the similar question earlier, short story that you know, might want to rewrite. Is there a short story by another writer that you wish you had written?
Brownies, ZZ Packer.
Yes, yes.
That story is so constructed and tightly wound and heartbreaking, and like the philosophical conceits about like race and like mental acuity and the way she takes it. I mean, that story just had me just spinning for like days afterwards. I'm like, what did I just read? How is this possible? And she rightly became famous on the back of that story in that collection because she was being so amazingly astute in what she put together.
I would love to know how you feel this collection challenged you as a writer or helped you grow or what about it surprised you in the process of writing it or publishing it?
Well, you know, again, I think that with short stories, it is a different approach to it. I think generally speaking, people are more receptive to novels because in a novel, you get this single character usually, and you're following this person throughout the course of their life. You get to know them. And so I think that's one of the reasons why if you ask a person, you know, name me five novel main characters you just love so much. No name like, you know, Gatsby or somebody from one of Toni Morrison's books, you know, that's fine. With short stories, there's this thing where it's more diffuse. And short stories are for people who just love literature. They just want to get into this space and experience this particular writer's tone and feel. And I think for me, I didn't know initially what my book was going to be about, as it were. When I put the collection together, I didn't know if there was a theme, if they were connected, what was the sort of overall emotional impact I wanted to have. And coming out of the experience, I looked back and I went, oh, I know what's happening here. So this is definitely your most New Orleans project. The stories are all set within the city limits. I literally tossed aside stories that left the city for any reason and put those in the back burner. This is a story in which you're trying to represent the people who are heard the least. So in this collection, you know, you don't get a lot of like powerful, you know, 6'5" black men running around doing stuff. These are a lot of people who are in different ways, either marginalized or on the margins of society. You know, they're homeless or they're struggling to make their ends meet, yada, yada, yada. And so for me, it was very cathartic figuring out like what kind of a writer I wanted to be in this space, in this collected space. And so I'm just very proud of it. I'm very proud of the fact that, again, I have characters you just don't see anywhere else. And their stories are being told in a way I think that's both respectful, honest, and enlightening to anybody who wants to read their stories.
I'm thinking about something that August Wilson said. He had this writing ritual where he would walk around his desk so many times before he sat down. But it, you know, clearly it worked for him. Do you have rituals like that? And can you describe for us how your writing space is set up?
Sure. It's two things in combination. When I was a very new writer, I had all these superstitions. Like I had to have like my special pen and like, a certain chair I sat in a coffee shop if I went out to the coffee shop. And I recognized that those superstitions were kind of holding me back. I was always too nervous to write without those things perfectly in place. And so I developed very early on this feeling of, Maurice, you can write anywhere at any time. So while I have spaces, like I'm right down in my space near LSU, I have my home in New Orleans as well. But really, my thing has always been have no spaces. Just show up somewhere. Mm-hmm. You can be in any city. You can be at like a friend's place and just get it going. Now, that being said, my favorite space of all time, which I think, Visha, you will experience at some point, is the the Grisham House over in Oxford,
yes.
Mississippi. And I have to say, you know, I'm very sort of like jaded about being too attached to a space. I like live off the land, so to speak. But there was mm-hmm. a comfort in that space. And there are pictures of it online, I'm pretty sure. Well, maybe not. But there's this feeling of like being in a space that is yours. It's very rural, so it's very quiet. And just like having control over the entire space for months at a time was just so cathartic and so freeing for me. Where by the end of my tenure there, I was just writing very efficiently. The two things came together. Mm. So I love that. And I guess my only requirements is this. A comfortable chair, a good table. And I need Wi-Fi because I'm one of the few writers who uses the internet while I'm writing constantly.
I am too.
Me too.
Yeah. I know some people are like, we turn it off because it's a distraction. I'm like, because I have to go and Google, you know, what was that obscure lyric, you know, Public Enemy lyric that now my character wants to say, and I have to look it up right now. you know,
right.
The essential things. And I, you know, I watched, was, you know, reading your Twitter feed when you were the Grisham Fellow. And then when I knew that I was going to follow in your footsteps, I was like, I hope that writing mojo and that space mojo, you know, rubs off on me and my next work. So I have just, you know, been watching you and with so much admiration. So thank you.
I left it there for you. It's under the kitchen cabinet.
Okay.
And I have to say, I'm also watching you for inspiration because you have been keeping us posted on your progress as you write new stuff. So what is next in the writing life of Maurice Carlos Ruffin? What are you working on? Anything you want to share about it or how it's going or how you're feeling about it, we'd love to hear it.
Oh, yeah, sure. So look, my third book is going to be my second novel. Again, I mentioned that idea of my first book being kind of this sort of demographically autobiographical. And I've been moving away from that more and more and more with each book that I write. So this next book has three major parts and three major time periods. And I got the idea for this during research of my woman ancestors. And so the first part is set in the 1840s to the 1860s. And this is the person who would be like my great-great-great-great-grandmother. The second part is in the 1940s to the 1960s, my grandmother's generation. And then the last part is set in the future, like We Cast a Shadow set in the future. And it's very much me trying to understand, frankly, as a man, like my mother, grandmother, and other relatives, sort of communal leanings. You know, men are often like, there's this sort of toxic masculine idea of like being a lone wolf. And a lot of struggles that men have is like being that kind of, you know, leave me alone, do my own thing, make my own choices. And I see my mother and I see, you know, my other relatives, and I kind of go, they work together so well. And so I'm trying to pay homage to that in the work. In the same way in like Song of Solomon, you know, Pilate and other people in the background, they're doing these things that are making their community better. And it's in all of Toni Morrison's books. The women are just amazing characters. And so I'm taking the guys sort of, they're almost like no guys who have like more than like a paragraph of like screen time in this new book so far. That's how I want to do it on purpose. I want to make sure that these women in New Orleans throughout history are, you know, front and center is their stories. I'm trying to tell this epic family tale that has the themes of like freedom and community and self-determination and living your best life, for lack of a better way of putting it.
Well, I will say I am so excited for that. I know, yes. Disha, you are too.
Yes.
And Maurice, we want to thank you so much for chatting with us today. I learned so much. I have my notes. I can't wait to get back to the page myself. Thank you so much for joining.
Y'all are the best. Thank you so much.
So I feel incredible after that conversation. I feel inspired. I feel blessed.
Absolutely. And, you know, he really is the nicest person on Twitter and, you know, just so generous. You know, his generosity always comes through. And I'm glad he recapped that formula because I remember taking those notes and he gives practical advice. So it's like it's soul advice, but then it's also practical advice that we can actually use in our writing practices. So I love that.
And it's so rare to get that kind of practical advice about craft to help you kind of break down your own stories and how to structure them. So I'm really appreciative of that. Thank you so much for listening. Remember, you can support the show, including author interviews and original audio stories, by going to ursastory.com/join.
Maurice will be like on the tweets, get back to work, get back to work. And I'm sitting there tweeting and wasting time and not working. And then there's this tweet, sit at your desk and do your work.